Hello and welcome to this edition of the Golf Channel Podcast with Rex and Lav. Unfortunately, we have to start with the tragic news that has happened, Rex, over the weekend with two-time PGA Tour winner Grayson Murray dead at the age of 30. His parents, in a statement released to the PGA Tour, saying that Murray took his own life on Saturday morning. Just an unbelievably sad story. Here's a player in Grayson Murray who won the Sony Open in January for his second PGA Tour title, was up to 58th in the world, was having his best season as a pro. He just made the cut in his two prior appearances at the major championships this year. He was exempt into next month's U.S. Open. He was sober for nearly a year, engaged to be married in late April. And Rex, the circumstances are still unknown, but Grayson Murray was one shot off the cut line this week when he pulled out of the Charles Schwab Challenge with two holes to play with what the tour cited as an illness. And now the news has come out on Sunday morning that Grayson Murray died by suicide. What is your reaction to this impossibly tragic story?
I mean, it was so sad. And I'm going to actually clear the floor here because you knew him much better than I did. I went back and read the feature you did about 2 years ago, 3 years ago now that you
six
wrote.
Or seven.
Oh, wow. Been a minute. Really good feature. I would recommend everyone to go read it because it does paint the picture of sort of this really talented individual who was clearly dealing with a lot of things. And I immediately went back to at Bay Hill earlier this year in March. I was working on a story specifically kind of June 6th, going back to Canada. I was just doing some out front reporting, trying to set some things up for what I think next week's going to be like. I'm going to be in Canada next week. And we all know what happened on June 6th, the framework agreement. And we also know that there was a player meeting that day and it was very heated. It was very contentious. The things we've learned since then, it was actually more contentious than I think we initially reported. But one of the exchanges was between Grayson and Rory McIlroy. And it was heated from everyone who I've talked to about it. And so I wanted to talk to Grayson about it. And again, I'm not nearly as close with him as you are. And I was a little apprehensive because you don't know if he was going to be combative. You didn't know if he just wanted to go away from this. And I was so taken that he was willing to sit down and talk for 10 or 15 minutes about what was clearly a very sensitive subject, but it's the way he addressed the subject. He no longer was coming at it from a player's point of view. He was very much looking at it from someone who he was on the player advisory council. He was more or less involved with the process now of what the tour is going to look like going forward. And I was taken by how here is a person that was portrayed in one way in the media, a bit of a hothead sometimes, a bit of a loose cannon, some of the things that he did on social media. And this version, the version I talked to at Bay Hill, the version you go back and read the transcripts from when he won at the Sony Open, the version that seemed to have found peace in his life, as you pointed out, that's not the player I think everyone knew. That's, in my mind, it's always going to be tragic when someone decides that things are so bad that the best option, the only option, is to take your own life. But in this particular case, it seems like he had figured everything out.
It certainly did. One of the words that keeps coming up when you talk to Grayson Murray's PGA Tour peers was misunderstood. And that was one of sort of the themes of the in-depth profile that I wrote on Grayson in 2017. And his parents even alluded to it today in the statement that they released, saying that, quote, life wasn't easy for Grayson. And although he took his own life, we know now that he rests peacefully. When I wrote that story back in 2017, that was Grayson Murray's rookie season on the PGA Tour. If you remember, he had sort of become embroiled in a bunch of social media controversies. But throughout the course of the reporting for that story, we discussed, Grayson and I did, as well as his parents, some of the dark secrets that he had been hiding from some of his PGA Tour peers. Essentially, he was dealing for the past decade plus with depression and social anxiety, which, if you don't know what social anxiety is, it's the fear of being judged and evaluated negatively by other people. That can lead to stuff like inadequacy, inferiority, embarrassment, humiliation, depression, all of which Grayson Murray has said openly that he has battled over the past decade or so. So that story sort of helped explain some of Grayson's behavior as a junior. It explained some of his behavior as a college player when he went to three colleges in just a handful of years. It explained why he had such a negative reaction, Grayson Murray did, to the concussion that he suffered in 2014 that sent him into a dark spiral and led to him being hospitalized for 10 days at a trauma center. So rereading that story now, Rex, as you did on Saturday, I mean, it was so foreboding. And it was amazing that he was able to accomplish what he did, given the some of the demons that he was battling.
I mean, it is. And one of the things, I wrote the story today about the statement that the parents sent out, and you're right, it was very poignant. But one of the things I did is I went back and just reread the transcript from when he won at the Sony Open, and he was kind of asked specifically about getting to this point. Now, you've been sober, I think, at that point for 8 months. You've dealt with all of these things. Like, what's that journey been like? And the quote was, and I'm going to read it. I know how much people hate when we read on the podcast, so I'll make this quick. A lot of hard work pays off. It's not easy. I want to give up a lot of times, give up on myself, give up on the game of golf, give up on life at times. Just persevere. And when you get tired of fighting, let someone else fight for you. That, to me, I mean, it was foreboding.
It's just such an impossibly sad story. And thinking about that story now, back in 2017, Grayson also had other demons over the past couple of years. He was quite open about how he would self-medicate with alcohol. That when he burst on the PGA Tour at 22, he would play some tournaments either drunk or hungover. That sort of helped with his depression, his anxiety that he was experiencing. But he had been sober, according to Grayson, back in January for at least 8 months. By that point, again, he was engaged to be married in late April. We don't know what triggered the action that he took on Saturday morning, but it's just so, so sad. And I think you see from either Peter Malnati or Webb Simpson, who were part of the CBS telecast on Saturday, as the outpouring of social media posts showed over the weekend, this has really rocked the PGA Tour community to its core. And so I'll be very curious to see what the PGA Tour continues to do as they honor Grayson's memory as we continue in 2024.
I'm glad you brought that up about the CBS telecast yesterday. Having those players on was very poignant, and it was important to hear from the other players because they were the ones that knew him the best out of this community. It's a traveling circus, but it's a bit of a family. And I tuned in early today, right from the start of the telecast, for the specific reason is I wanted to see how CBS was going to handle this. And I've not been in this particular situation, but I've been on air when you're having to sort of make the transition from something very, very serious and something very, very sad like this back to sports, which, let's be honest, it's a bit of a playground, what we do. Like, I think we take it too seriously sometimes, and it's such an impossible thing to do. And I was kind of curious, like, how is Jim Nantz and the rest of the team going to do it? And I have to admit, I was just filled with pride the way they seemed to handle it. Very well. It was a very light touch. I thought they talked about Harry Higgs, who won for the second consecutive week on the Korn Ferry Tour today. They kind of referenced the speech that he gave, and clearly he knew Grace and he was close with him. But he talked about be nice to each other. Harry Higgs did in his speech. And that was sort of the message that Grayson's parents were trying to send out in their statement. And my guess said it would be a message that Grayson held very close to his heart, because it's important to understand that even though somebody is a professional golfer and has won twice on the PGA Tour and seems to have this gladiator exterior, there's still things going on inside, and that stands for all of us.
And Grayson had been so open about some of the demons that he was struggling with, and I think that is helpful. I think it's helpful, too, that his parents came out on Sunday morning about 24 hours after the fact to say that Grayson died by suicide, and you get the hotline, and those who are in need of help now have it if they can take some sort of solace in what the family is dealing with as well. And I think it's an important moment too, Rex, to acknowledge just how prevalent mental health is, and being able to be open and honest with your behaviors, with your feelings, what you're battling. I think Grayson was a prime example of that. And if you see some of the social media clips that have recirculated over the past year, I think a lot of people can find strength from what he was dealing with as well. All right. We will somehow transition now to golf and the tournament that, again, was played per Grayson Murray's parents' wishes. Players wore black and red ribbons on Sunday for the final round. That was a tribute to Grayson and the Carolina Hurricanes, his favorite NHL team, near his hometown of Raleigh, North Carolina. The tournament, Rex, was won by Davis Riley, I think in somewhat surprising fashion, with the golf course, which was redone over the past year at Colonial, completely baked out. They were dealing with 25, 30 mile an hour winds. Obviously, the firm golf course having just undergone the renovation. It was a brutal day for golf. And Davis Riley, all he needed was a final round 70 to win by 5 shots. That wasn't the surprising part. If you are a follower of this podcast or a longtime follower of junior and college golf, like, the kid has been very good over the past decade. He was the number one ranked junior player, great standout college player as well. Won with Nick Hardy in the team event last year at the Zurich Classic. This was his first individual title. The surprise to me was that he beat Scotty Scheffler as soundly as he did. Davis Riley playing the final group of Scotty Scheffler. I did not see what the odds makers listed Scotty.
They were
heading
even
into the final round.
That's all.
Four
they
shots
were even.
Back. I mean, that's crazy. And for him to dust them the way that he did, with Davis Riley shooting a 70 and Scotty Scheffler coming home with a 71 when he was really struggling for much of the day. That was, to me, the biggest surprise on Sunday.
Well, I want to separate those two things out, because I do think Davis Riley is interesting and he deserves flowers and all the style points we could possibly give him. Because you're right. You go head to head with the world number one on a demanding golf course like that. And I also want to talk a little bit about the golf course. You and I aren't architecture geeks, but I do think it's kind of cool what they did at Colonial. And it shouldn't go unnoticed that 14 under won this week's event and 21 under won last week's event. And last week was a major championship. So there is a lesson probably to be learned there, not so much at Valhalla, but just across golf. I wanted to actually touch on the idea that Scotty Scheffler didn't make a birdie until the 13th hole. And they were even money coming into it. I did look up, actually a degenerate buddy of mine looked last night when we were talking about this, which made sense to me because it was Scotty Scheffler. And you would think that once he sort of shook off what happened last week and got back between the ropes, that the juices were going to stop flowing. All that being said, I think it's fair to say it's impossible to imagine that what happened last Friday, well, 2 Fridays ago now, at Valhalla on Shelbyville Road, him getting arrested, everything that has transpired since then, that this is going to be with him for a long time. And I'm not saying that's why he didn't win. I'm not saying that's why he didn't win last week. But there's certainly something to be said for, and both of us had a chance to sort of see this firsthand, that once it sunk in, and he realized that this just wasn't a traffic ticket. This is a felony. He's been accused of assaulting a police officer. This is very important. And I kind of see it. And I actually spoke with someone inside his camp last week about this after the press conference with the mayor of Louisville and the police chief of Louisville, because it's really easy for you and I and those of us sort of on the outside to look and be like, come on. I mean, this is going to work itself out. Like, there's no way what the police report says happened, not with that guy. Like, it's really, really hard to wrap your mind around it. But the fact of the matter is, it's still ongoing and it's still hanging over his head. And I would say with some degree of certainty that what we saw today and probably what we've seen over the last week and a half is the direct result of that. He was on a historic tear. He had a chance to come in. He was the heavy favorite. He'd won 4 or 5 coming into the PGA Championship. Like, had he won last week, we would have started speaking breathlessly about the single season Grand Slam. And yet here we are now. So I do think the events of last Friday have impacted him to some degree. Obviously, he can still play really, really good golf. He finished second. But I think to some degree, it's taken a bit of the edge off.
I think that's fair to say. I mean, Scotty had not shot over par in a round of golf in 2024. And now he has done it 3 of his last 6 rounds. One last week, the PGA Championship, 2 this week at the Charles Schwab Challenge, including in the final round when, again, he shot a 1 over 71. I'm with that. I'm not sure that it made that was the difference maker on Sunday. He flat out just did not play well. Hit half of the fairways, hit half the greens, didn't really make any of those sort of like momentum saving putts that he has wanted to do over these past 5 months. I think this was more a tribute to the difficulty of the golf course, the firmness of the golf course, and particularly when you're getting these crosswinds. Like, he could not find enough fairways to get that spark. And again, he began the final round 4 shots back. It was going to take something into mid to high 60s in order to chase down Davis Riley, assuming that he was going to get some help from a player who's largely inexperienced. And the fact that he was unable to put that pressure on him early, finding the rough, having to hit sort of these knuckleball shots out of the thick Bermuda rough to very firm greens that weren't going to hold. I think it was more a case of being off his game plus a difficulty of the golf course, as opposed to him thinking about his arraignment that has now been rescheduled for June 3rd.
Well, I'm going to push back on that a little bit, because the idea that he just wasn't on, okay, that's one way to put it. I mean, there's Could the reason he just wasn't on be, yes, it was a very difficult golf course. Yes, he was up.
He just shot 63 on Saturday.
Well, and again, he shot 66 on Friday after he got out of the Department of Corrections in Louisville. So clearly he has the ability to compartmentalize. But I think it would be almost unhuman of him not to let this in the back of his mind. Like he's not that good at compartmentalizing. Nobody is that good at compartmentalizing. And in the quiet moments when you're walking down a fairway waiting to get to your next shot, it's going to creep into your mind. It's only human. It's only natural for those things to be hanging over his head. And for him to be the person, look, we wouldn't be having this conversation if it would have happened to, and I'm not even going to name other players, but if it was another player, I can probably tell you that, yeah, they're going to dismiss it because they know that nothing's going to come of this and they're going to be fine. I think because of the person Scotty is and because of the reason that we all think that, I don't think that's the way it went down on that dark road that morning, that's going to be the part that makes it difficult for him.
I don't, I certainly see your point in the fact that he did not have.
Can we clip that around wrinkling my nose and everything and doing them, you know.
Yeah, we probably should. That one can go viral. For 4 months, did not shoot over par. Now three of his last six rounds has been over par, and they have all been after the incident. I totally get that. And in tournament golf, there's a lot of idle time where your mind can go a whole lot of places. Keep in mind, he just had a kid less than a month ago.
Sure.
He's dealing with all of that. The legal drama, the uncertainty that's surrounding that. Obviously, he is going to have to appear in court on June 3rd. We'll get into that in just a second. I do not discount the fact that that has been an incredible distraction. I actually think it is a testament to Scotty's resilience and his focus and his concentration that he has been able to finish in the top 10 at a major championship after spending time in jail, finished in the top 10, and then now tied for second just a week later and a few days removed from a press conference in which the police chief and the mayor both said that there is zero indication that these charges against Scottie Scheffler are going to get dropped. I think anyone else that leads to either a withdrawal, a miscut, a weekend implosion. I think this week it leads to a miscut and your head's going elsewhere and you just kind of shut it down to Memorial and some of your U.S. Open prep. The fact that Scottie Scheffler is still highly competitive with all of this swirling around to him, I think is actually a tribute to his concentration and focus and his ability to stay in the moment and the golf shots that are on hand.
Oh, I don't disagree with that. I just say there's a finite amount of that within anyone, even Scottie Scheffler. Even like, look, we saw this from Tiger Woods on numerous occasions where he was able to compartmentalize things going on off the golf course and still do magical things on the golf course. I do think he's got an element of that gear, some part of it, but there are limits to it. I truly believe that.
And an update, since we last potted, as mentioned, Louisville mayor and police chief gave a press conference on Thursday in which they discussed the ongoing Scotty case and released some video footage, not, of course, of the initial interaction between Scotty Scheffler and Detective Brian Gills, which, of course, is the source of much debate. Three takeaways, Rex. Let's see if you agree from the press conference with the police chief and the mayor. One, again, they did not give an indication the charges against Scotty Scheffler would be dropped. There's still time, of course, for that to happen before June 3rd. The arresting officer, Brian Gills, did not have his body cam activated, and he was subsequently reprimanded for that. And Scotty Scheffler, per his attorney, is not interested in a settlement and will either go to trial or have the charges dismissed. Because it is a felony charge that Scotty is facing, he does have to appear in court on June 3rd, which is the Monday of Memorial Week. So 8 days from now when we are recording this podcast. What is your take on these latest developments in the case?
Oh, I think there's a fourth element, however it is, OTI, outside looking in, whatever the case may be. And that's the videos don't show anything. What we see from both angles, there's a still camera that's on a pole across the street and from a dashboard camera from one of the law enforcement officers' cars. But all you see is sort of the aftermath of whatever happened behind that bus. And so we still don't have any idea, a clue. It's clearly on one side, you had the police report and you pointed out Detective Gillis. And that side of the story, we have not heard Scotty Scheffler's side of the story other than it was a big misunderstanding. And he felt like it was all going to get cleared up. But that didn't bring us any closer to clarity than we were before that press conference. So that was my first and foremost takeaway. And the second one is, to your point, Detective Gillis was reprimanded for not having his body camera footage per department policy. You can go through the policy and it's very, very specific. As a matter of fact, they actually reference the idea that the second you get in that car, your cruiser, and you're in uniform and you're on your way to work, you probably need to activate it. And even though in this particular case, it's easy to dismiss, okay, he's just directing traffic, you probably didn't need to have it on. The second it turned into not about directing traffic, but chasing after someone to arrest them, we still don't have a very good understanding of why he never activated this body cam footage.
The pants, per his statement, were damaged beyond repair, $80 yeah. pants, roughly. I mean, what case do you have if there is no body cam footage or no dash cam footage of the initial interaction, which again is a source of much debate of what actually happened? Because right now it's a he said, he said. Guy Shepard said it was a big misunderstanding and he was just trying to get to the gym to work out ahead of his tea time. Detective Brian Gillis said that he was, per the incident report, was dragged 10 or 20 yards until Scottie Scheffler stopped accelerating forward. What case do they possibly have if we do not have video evidence of the initial interaction?
You and I went round and round about this in Louisville before we left, if you remember correctly, where you kind of made the same comment. And I said, under normal circumstances, many cases are brought to courts where it's one side is the law enforcement officer and his side of the story, and the other side is the defendant and their side of the story. And so it's always a matter of interpretation. There's not always video evidence. There's not always witnesses. Like, sometimes this is what these types of things come down to. As kind of a rule of law, you're going to lean towards the law enforcement officer. This is the person that's been tasked in the community to uphold the law. So as a rule, the courts normally lean in that direction. However, I would say in this case, there's a couple of things acting against, not specifically Detective Gillis, but certainly the Louisville Metro PD. First and foremost among them is that in March of this year, just 2 months ago, the Department of Justice came down with multiple violations of civil rights violations. And one of them was undue arrest, undue process, all of the things that you can imagine Scottie is going to bring out, and if this ever does go to court. So already the department's got a strike against it, and I don't want to try this case in public, but I can understand where his lawyer, Stephen Romines, is coming from when it's like, we're not settling. Like, we're not going to do this. This is outrageous. This is a department that's already found itself in trouble for multiple reasons, being a little over aggressive, arrests that weren't quite above board, whatever the case may be. And now you have the world number one, who, according to multiple reports that I read, had been told to do one thing by one law enforcement officer. And then when he ran across Detective Gillis, everything unraveled. It's behind the bus. We can't see it. So it's not quite clear cut. And I don't know. I would imagine that we never see this get to trial. But if it does, it would be an interesting argument on both sides.
Should be a busy week in the world of golf this week, Rex. The U.S. Women's Open at Lancaster Country Club. The Men's NCAA Championship. Get started at least on Golf Channel. It's already been underway for a couple of days now. This is the first NCAAs I've missed.
I was about to say
since 2010. So it has been a long time. And you were heading up for the RBC Canadian Open in a new spot. It has always been the prelude to the U.S. Open, a different spot on the schedule. It does not sync up perfectly with June 6th of last year, which is when the golf world blew up. But what are you anticipating as Roy McIlroy, Nick Taylor and company head north of the border for the Canadian Open this week?
I mean, we're going to revisit it. You're right. It doesn't sync up perfectly. But as I pointed out, I mean, that was such a big and pivotal day in golf, just the announcement itself and then the player meeting that followed and all of the fallout and everything that's happened since then. And sort of swept under the rug of everything else that's happened over the last 7 days or so, it seems to me things are moving along at a different clip when it comes to the negotiations between the Public Investment Fund and the PGA Tour. There was an emergency board meeting last week. I believe it was on Tuesday. The PAC met last week at Colonial as well. Commissioner Jay Monahan was on property multiple times. He flew back actually on Saturday. He was meeting with players, from what I've been told. He was meeting with agents. There's a lot of whispering going on. So I guess the best thing to say is it's happening. Whatever it is, it's happening.
What does that mean? What does that possibly mean?
My understanding, and look, this is going to play out one way or the other. However, my understanding is that the PGA Tour has sent a proposal of what they think the world of golf would look like if you find a way to get the PIF invested in PGA Tour Enterprise, and of course that would bring LIV Golf in. So whatever that option is, and I can only imagine, you know, we can sit here and go through all the different all the different options. I can only imagine what that looks like. They haven't heard back for quite a while from the public investment fund. So my guess is they received some sort of feedback from the PIF about maybe they want to do this and maybe there's some non-starters, whatever the case may be. Depending on who you ask, I mean, again, Jordan Spieth has kind of become the outspoken spokesperson of the PGA Tour policy board. If you ask him, things are moving along perfectly.
Everything's great.
Everything's great.
False narrative. False narrative that there's so much infighting.
And yet Jimmy Dunn retired less than 2 weeks ago now. He was instrumental. He was the architect of the framework agreement. He stepped down from the policy board last weekend under the cover of darkness and no one reported it. Mark Flaherty stepped down from the PGA Tour policy board. No, that's right. Someone did report it. It was me, but you apparently weren't paying attention. You were too busy writing.
Under the radar.
Under the radar. Yeah. No, it wasn't. It wasn't. It was above the radar. It was right on top of the radar. That's the way it worked out. But yeah, so whatever that means, and that's some terrible reporting. That's some really bad insider stuff right there. Something's happening, but that's the best I got right now.
Thankfully, you'll be our man on the ground at the RBC Canadian Open. Of course, we will do the podcast on Wednesday.
Where are you going to be? You're still going to be in that rustic lodge, wherever it is you are right now.
I will be home. My wife is heading on a bachelorette party in Jackson Hole, so I will be hunkered down with my two children, without any assistance. Pray for Lav. Most certainly, typically at this point of the podcast, Rex, we do something silly. I do not feel that is appropriate, given the news that we had this weekend. So I will sign off with one final message. Hug your loved ones. Check in with those who are dealing with life. You don't know what sort of message you can leave with them and what sort of impact you can have. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of the Golf Channel Podcast with Rex and Lav. You guys know the drill, mcsports.com/golf for all latest news, notes, and updates on the developing story that we have been covering over the past 48 hours. Rex and I will be back on Wednesday. He in Canada, me in Ponte Vedra. Until then, be well.
Be kind.